listening to Critical Mass, right here on OC Talk Radio. Well, normally it's hosted by Rick Franzi, but today you've got me sitting in here, Paul Roberts. I'm usually the producer, the person behind the curtain, and today I get to step out as I attempt to fill some big shoes and guest host for Rick, who couldn't be here. Our thoughts and prayers are still with he and his wife. I know his wife's father is quite ill down in Florida, and so that's where they're at for this week. So we'll try and do the best we can in his absence and continue the tradition of finding out and exploring what's going out there with the world of business so that everyone can make better, more informed decisions. Let me just start by saying that Rick Franzi and his partner Doug Gefeller own a business called Critical Mass for Business, this being the radio show part of that, Critical Mass, the radio show, and they also have a number of books out on various subjects, including CEO peer groups and their newest book, which will be coming out next month, on guiding principles, CEO guiding principles. It's a culmination of what they've learned in the past year on this radio show, people talking about that issue. So lots of interesting content that's available from their website, www.criticalmassforbusiness. And as they always say, let me announce that Critical Mass, the radio show, is an extension of their 17-year consulting practice. Rick Franzi and Doug Gefeller, as partners, build CEO peer groups for executives and business owners here in Orange County, California, in partnership with Renaissance Executive Forums. Renaissance Executive Forums is an international organization committed to helping members take their business to the next level. Rick wrote the definitive guide, really, on CEO peer groups. I don't know that anybody's done it better than he did with his book, Critical Mass, The 10 Explosive Powers of CEO Peer Groups, which is available. I think it's on its third printing now through Amazon.com. If you haven't picked up a copy, you should certainly do that. You can get it through our website here, OC Talk Radio, our store, or you can also just Google his name, Richard Franzi, at Amazon.com. And Doug is best known for being a master certified coach, a distinction that's achieved by less than 900 certified coaches in the world. That's a pretty small number when you consider it that way. Doug is the lead partner in charge of the coaching practice for Critical Mass. And Doug also hosts a call-in show right here on OC Talk Radio called The Coaching Perspective every Thursday at 4 p.m. So tomorrow you'll get a chance to hear that. And last but not least, if you do want to join in the conversation today, we invite you to go to the community chat room, which you'll see on the left side of your screen if you're listening live, and you can actually chat away and we can pass your questions on to the host if they're appropriate. Or if we think it'll interject something else into the conversation. And it also gets tweeted and all sorts of things. If you're listening later through a podcast, you're out of luck for asking live, but you can certainly email us, and we can pass your questions on to the guest. And what a guest we have today. We have with us Candy Williams from the law offices of Candy Williams. Welcome to the show, Candy.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
Okay. I didn't say do a big build-up here, so you'll have to tell us, since Rick and you had spoken, I'm as ignorant as the rest of the audience. What are the law offices of Candy Williams? Tell us what you do there.
Well, I do a general corporate practice, and I do a small litigation practice. And
okay.
So, to give you some background, and I had talked to Rick about this, when I started out practicing law, I clerked for a judge first after law school, and then I worked for several large law firms, and that's what led me into my corporate practice. And I used to work for very large clients, clients that were already on the road to going public or that were already public. And so now I mostly represent the entrepreneur and the early stage startup company.
Okay. And how do you like that? Is that more exciting or crazier, or how do you compare the two?
Well, you know, it's definitely exciting, but in a different way. Whereas before, the dollar figures on my deals were a lot larger,
right.
But now I'm definitely more involved with my clients. You know, I help them start their company, get it off the ground, running, protect their IP, few trademarks, and then if they have any problems, you know, then we work with that down the road. So I definitely feel like I am more involved with my clients.
Okay.
And how, more exciting.
And how do they find you, or maybe the other way, how do you find them?
Most of them are just referrals from either friends, family, word of mouth, business associates, clients refer me to new clients. You know, just pretty much how it works with the big firms as well.
Okay, okay. Do you do any direct marketing? I'm always curious about this because I know there are a variety of regulations placed on attorneys.
We can't do target solicitations or anything like that. We're prohibited from doing that. I am affiliated with an all-female group called Montage Legal Group, and we have a website and a Twitter account and a Facebook account and a blog and that sort of thing, and that has drawn in many clients and many referrals.
Okay.
So it's just amazing how small the world is right now.
Well, let's talk about that because you're on internet radio, and again, we tend to view this as another form of social media. It's another way mm-hmm. to start a conversation and to share that with people so that hopefully not only will they learn about you, but maybe they can connect with you. Maybe they can learn from you, and maybe you can become part of their community here. So how did you create this group? Were you part of creating it, or did you join this Montage Legal Group?
I joined it after several other women with whom I practiced at the same firm. They practiced years after I was there, but we had all practiced at the same large law firm, and they left after they had children because they couldn't meet or decided they didn't want to meet the demands of a traditional law practice. And so mm-hmm. they came up with this concept, which is apparently fairly novel, that an all-female group would get together and decide to affiliate like this.
Yeah,
and
right.
our goal is to achieve some sort of work-life balance, which is also virtually unheard of in the law firm world.
Being an attorney and work-life balance, I'll share some things with you that maybe the audience knows or don't know. I went to law school, but I did not finish. I went to William and Mary at Williamsburg, Virginia, and way back in the 70s, decided I hated everything about the whole thing, didn't like any of it. I wasn't the top 10% of my class, so I didn't flunk out. I always have to say that for my parents' sake. But I left after the first year, and my roommate went on to become a very successful attorney, a gentleman named David Griffith, and who now hosts the show on doing business in Asia here on this network. He actually did one earlier today. And the point of the whole story is, they used to call him the Moss Man because when he started working, he would bill literally 20 to 24 hours. He actually billed 24 hours in one day somehow. I don't know how he did that.
Oh my goodness.
And that was the norm. As a young associate, you were supposed to put in, you know, inhuman hours like that.
Which is absolutely true. I've definitely pulled many all-nighters. I have traveled. I have left at the printer when we were doing an IPO. I have done all that. And so, you know, obviously once you reach a certain age and you have a family,
right.
You can't necessarily live that life anymore. But yet you still want to practice law and you still have all these skills and great education and great experience that you want to give back to your clients.
Right, right.
And so that's where my legal group comes in, and that's where I come in that because I still have the training and experience that you get from a large law firm,
right.
But I can't necessarily work those, you know, I can't work 60 or 70 hours a week anymore, so this is sort of a good balance.
And I always wonder, I mean, I don't know how Dave would answer this question, but I'll put it to you. You know, I suppose there's some value. You're supposed, like in law school, you're supposed to work hard and you're supposed to prove yourself and all these things. But is that really healthy for the client if you're working 60-hour, 80-hour weeks, you know, that? I mean, are you really giving them your best effort? Or what I would argue, I'm going to show my hand, do you bring something a little more human to the equation if you have a life and have other outside interests and awareness and stuff? It seems like there's a little, you bring something different to the equation if you're not just a machine.
You know, I absolutely agree with you. And I also think there's a law of diminishing returns. I think at a certain point, you're not as valuable to your client if mm-hmm. you're overworked and overly tired and you can't meet those clients' demands, and I don't think you can provide effective representation. Whereas if you have a normal life, I think, just like you said, you bring so much more to the table, and I think you're better able to meet your clients' demands.
And one of the things that lawyers always get a bad rap for is not being sensitive to the issues, you know, sort of like doctors. One case becomes another, and you, I guess you try and I guess you can't get emotionally attached to each of these cases or you'd go crazy, but, you know, talk about that a little bit. If you're focusing on an entrepreneur, he needs more than just occasional documents to be filed. He probably needs some guidance, too, here. And so you take on a different role, I would suspect, and therefore they want a different kind of attorney who can, you know, be there as a consultant, advisor, friend, you know, shoulder to cry on, other sorts of things. It seems like you're called upon to do more. And therefore, if you had the kind of life you're talking about, maybe you can be a little more human in your reactions with the client here.
You know, I think you're exactly right. And I think that that is the benefit of what I get to do, because I get to work more closely with smaller clients. Instead of having a piece of a very large transaction for a very large client, I now get, you know, everything from start to finish with smaller clients. And
right,
so I get
right.
to develop a better relationship with my clients, more rapport, and there's definitely more of a sense that I feel more involved with their business. I feel more like a business partner than just an attorney who's preparing documents for them.
Right, right, right. You're not just a hired gun in there to, you know, file documents endlessly here. You have some attachment to what they're doing, some feeling for what you're doing here.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about what you learned at the big firms. I obviously never made it that far here, and I know that it's a different world. I watched the show. My wife loves to watch The Good Wife, you know, that with, I don't know if it's realistic or not, this cutthroat world of the big firms here. What did you learn there that's helped you as a guiding principle? Did you discover anything there that that you've continued on into your private practice here?
I learned many things. One is that I do not want to be cutthroat like that. I have seen
okay.
people cut other people down to get better deals. And an attorneys may not have necessarily had their client's best interest at heart, because there is an inherent conflict because we bill by the hour.
Right.
So there are chances to resolve something or do something faster. And I've definitely seen this when I worked at larger firms, that maybe things were done at a slower pace than they could have been done just because you end up making more money. That's just how the business works. That's just how it works. And now that I'm on my own, I don't want to do it that way. You know, I don't want to just bill my clients to make money. I want to build a relationship, because a relationship is what is going to bring me more clients down the road.
Exactly. And I think that's appealing to people when they're starting, because I'm sure they have lots of questions, and every time they pick up the phone, they want the meter to start running. They probably can't afford to have the meter running every time they pick up the phone and ask you something here. And so they, you know, they need you, but they need you in a different capacity than just to, you know, answer a question and file a document here.
No, you're exactly right. But so I just try to be more of a team player with my clients and try to help them out. And I always tell people, if you have a lot of questions, just try to bundle all your questions together.
There you go.
So that we don't waste time on one little question that's going to take up 20 minutes. We could probably knock them all out in 30. That sort of thing.
I'll give you another interesting aside. Again, this friend of mine who now hosts a show on this network was talking to another attorney today, and they were talking about resolving international law cases and very complex things. And the one attorney from up in Beverly Hills said, well, you know, I was fortunate, and they were talking about a specific case, and she said, I was fortunate that I had a reasonable attorney on the other side, and we were able to resolve this. And Dave started laughing, and he said, I'm sure everybody in the audience is laughing. You know, the words reasonable and attorney don't seem to go together very often.
It's definitely an oxymoron, that's for sure.
What, any other sort of guiding principles that you use? You know, what if someone were to pin you and say, okay, what is your guiding, I kept trying to think of another way to describe it, but really is that, you know, what's the star that keeps you pointed in the right direction in your business?
You know, it's changed through the years. I would say right now, I don't know if Rick mentioned this to you, but I'm actually doing a little temporary thing at the Orange County DA's office.
Oh,
where they bring in civil attorneys in their trial attorney partnership program, and they let us do felony preliminary hearings and jury trial. So I actually just recently won my first jury trial.
There you go. Congratulations.
And thank you. And what I learned in that is that actually the biggest thing I learned since I've been here is that I do not accept anything at face value. even though somebody thinks it makes sense and they sort of gloss over it, I've learned to delve a little further into the facts and just try to figure out what makes sense to me, because if it doesn't make sense to me, it won't make sense to a judge or a jury.
Yeah.
And then in my own practice, it won't make sense to, for example, if my client has a business plan that doesn't make sense or any sort of growth plan that doesn't make sense, then I know if it doesn't make sense to me, it's not going to make sense to future investors.
So what you're saying is it's sort of got to pass the logic test here. It's got to resonate with you if you're going to make it resonate with the jury and other people here.
Exactly right. And that's something that translates into my own practice. I don't think investors want smoke and mirrors. I think they want plain language, and they really want to know what your business plan is. And so that's what I always tell my clients.
But you've identified one of the areas that I always struggled with when I was in law school, and that is this idea that you can argue either side of the case, as they make you do in law school. And I would continually say, but who should win? And they'd always say the same thing. Don't worry about who should win. Worry about who could win. You know, that's not your role as an attorney, supposedly, to make sense of these things here. You're just supposed to make the best argument you can. So what you're saying seems to run a little counter to what I learned in law school 20 years ago.
Well, I think what they do in law school is they train you to be able to take either side. But I think when you get out in the real world, you see that you have a certain bent one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, in my own practice, when I read something, I can certainly take an argument on my client's behalf, but I would never make an argument that didn't make sense to me. And I always tell them, if this doesn't make sense to me, it just doesn't make sense. This is not going to work.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, interesting. Let's talk then a little bit about, let's talk about anything that you've learned in dealing with your clients that in an early stage company that might provide some insights for our audience. Most of the people who listen to the show are small to mid-sized businesses who are trying to learn from others. So what sort of things could you pass on to them, maybe about starting, about the whole early stage process?
First, consult an attorney and consult your attorney often. I think even though people are afraid of attorneys because it costs money to talk to us, we're going to save you headaches in the long run, because people always think it's just better to go ahead and go out and do the deals and just do whatever they want to do and come back and because it's better to ask forgiveness and permission. But I always tell people it's so much better to get an attorney and run every major business decision through your attorney, not necessarily before you make the decision, but just before you implement it, because it may require corporate approvals. It may not be legal to do what you're doing, or you may have to take further steps to make it legal. For example, I have clients, they want to bring in other investors, but obviously to do so, we have to comply with all the securities laws. So I always say you need to always run everything by me. Even if it's a minor thing, go ahead and run it by me, and if it's fine, then it's fine. But if not, it could cause larger problems down the road if I find out about it later, because it's harder to clean up down the road than it is to clean it up on the front end.
I think that is so important. I want to stress that to people, because I've been involved in some IPOs and early stage things. And in the beginning, you just want to go out and raise money. You just want to talk to people about it.
Mm-hmm.
And in today's world, more than ever, it is very regulated what you can and cannot say and to whom you can say this. So talk about that a little bit. Let's expand upon that. You've got all these people who are eager and suddenly want to tell everybody, hey, give me your money and jump into this thing here. And yet if they do it wrong, they can really get themselves in some deep trouble here.
And this happens all the time. And
right.
I'm always having to tell people you can't just go out and take money from people. It has to be, if you're going to do an offering, we have to do it a certain way so it complies with the securities laws. You can't just go out and say everything you want about your business.
Right.
You obviously can't make a false or misleading statement or omission, or you're going to violate securities laws, not to mention other laws. So we just have to be really careful. Everything needs to be very controlled, and everything you say needs to have some sort of backup. So that's the first thing I advise. The second thing is, just because somebody is willing to give you a check, and I know in this economy this is a little tougher, you may not want that person an investor in your business. And so I always tell people, think about strategically, is this somebody that you really want to be in bed with down the road, or, could you wait a little longer and try to find a more strategic investor? And again, that's harder in this economy because there's not a lot of money changing hands, but it's still definitely advice I give.
I'm going to amplify that again based on what I've heard on this show. I can't tell you the number of people, we're going to ask you this in a second here, but so many people, when they talk about a painful experience in their business career, talk about bad partnerships. They got started, they got in bed with the wrong person, it looked great, it sounded great, and later on it turned out to be a nightmare. And the price they paid, the time it took, the destruction that did to their business to extricate themselves from that situation is awful. Any stories to share on that? Because that's what it seems to come back and bite you. You take this money and get involved with these people, and then all of a sudden it becomes a hit, and suddenly the marriage isn't working, you know.
Right. In fact, I always tell people that a business divorce is more common than a real divorce.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you need to protect yourself in the front end, and that every time you start a company and you have at least one other person involved with you, you need to have some protective provisions in there, like a buy-sell agreement or something along those lines, because just like I said, a business divorce is more common than a real divorce, and so this needs to be your prenup, because it's better to go ahead and flesh it out now when everybody is all happy and googly-eyed with each other than down the road when things go awry.
We had the gentleman who founded the Yard House, a very successful restaurant chain that started in Long Beach and then quickly moved to Orange County here, and they took in some partners and some outside money and allowed them to grow to 29 stores, I think, if I'm not mistaken. And one of the things that the founder talked about was getting out of a bad partnership. He got into a situation that he needed to get out of early on, and how awful and difficult that was, and how it took his whole focus away from the business, really, for a while to do that.
It's so true. I had that happen to a client that I took on after they had already had problems with their partnership, and so I've heard their story, and it was exactly the same thing on a smaller scale. It detracts from your business. It costs money. Like I said, it's more draining, or it's as draining as a real divorce, but it can also have ramifications that affect your business, you know, forever.
Yeah.
So definitely think on the front end about who you want to be in business with, and even if you trust this person absolutely and implicitly, you need to get everything in writing. Everything needs to be sorted out just so there's no fight down the road.
Right. Okay, well, let's get to the question that everybody winces a little bit when Rick asks, but it kind of goes to this core thing. You know, we're talking about what your clients, painful lessons your clients have learned. What painful lessons have you learned that you could share with us and maybe somebody out there would connect with and say, boy, I thought I was the only one that had that problem, or hey, I never thought about that. Maybe I should think some more so I don't repeat your problem. What painful lessons have you learned along the way?
You know, that's a good question. I wouldn't call the lessons necessarily painful. I would just say that I've definitely learned the value of my relationships with my clients. And as I talked about this before briefly, that I really value the relationship, and I'm not going to value my billable hour or my hourly rate over the relationship in the long term. And so I'm always going to work with somebody on that, and I'm not just going to build them to death just to make a profit, because I really want a relationship. It's a relationship that's going to lead to further business. And I also want my clients to know that as well. And I expect the same thing on the other end. I don't expect people to take advantage of me because I feel that way. So I think that the biggest thing I've learned from my experience is that I want to create a good relationship with my clients where we have good communication, because when communication breaks down, everything goes awry.
Oh, so it's going to be with you, Paul.
Yeah, let's do, I'm sorry, I'm trying to do two things at once here. Listen to your questions, and I've got a caller in here, too. Let's talk about the flip side, then. Give us some positive lessons that you learned, maybe from the big firms, maybe from law school, maybe from life. But, you know, what have you learned in starting your own business here?
Oh, that's a good question. And starting my own business.
I got lots of good questions today here. I got all sorts
of... You do. I've learned, you know what? Lawyers are generally not good business people. That's one thing I have definitely learned. And I think that, they're so focused on being attorneys and giving legal advice. They're not focused on the business of being an attorney. And so that's something I've had to learn and pick up on. And unfortunately, I have good mentors out there who've done exactly what I'm doing, and so they've kind of helped me along the way. But I've definitely learned from the mistakes that I've seen made in the past by how some firms have treated clients, and because I don't view somebody as just a, somebody who's going to pay my bills. I see us in a relationship together, and then I'm more their outside general counsel, because most of my clients can't afford to bring somebody in-house, so I sort of act as their outside general counsel. So I just try to work with them and keep the relationship going and value their relationship in the long term versus my short term bill being paid every month.
Okay. I'm going to ask you the question I like to ask everybody. This is maybe something, I'll throw you a little bit of a curve here, but think about this. You know, you're involved in the law, and today that is a real source of contention. Do we have too many laws? Do we have too few laws? Does government regulate too many things? Is it not regulate enough? And I want to ask you to answer that political question, but kind of hand in hand with that, we've gone through this great recession, as they call it here. And I guess I'm always curious to ask people, you know, in your world, do you think that this was just a 100-year storm and it passed? It was awful, but it's over now and the sun's going to come out and everything is going to go back to just the way it was. Or has this experience changed us some way? And I think particularly the law. You know, is this going to lead to more regulation or less regulation? Is this going to lead to a different approach to legal issue? Are people going to be more... are more contentious, or are they going to be less likely to attack, sue each other? I don't know. I mean, what do you see?
You know, that's a good question, Paul. I think what happens every time there's something in the news, some big scandal, whether it be Enron 10 years ago or whether it be the mortgage industry in the last few years, that there's always some sort of reaction by the legislature to make more laws to regulate that industry.
Right.
And then I think things become really tight for a while, and then the pendulum kind of swings back somewhere in the middle some years after that. And so I think, you know, that's what's happening right now, obviously. And then I think in a few years we'll kind of reach some sort of even keel, but there'll be some other scandal down the road, and there'll be some sort of reactionary laws passed, just like there always are. And so we just have to deal with it. You know, my job as an attorney is not to judge the laws that are there. I you know, we have to work in the regulatory framework that
exactly.
we have.
Right. So how do you keep your clients ahead of the curve then? Because it seems like just when we think the rules, we all know the rules change, either because of economic circumstances or because of some crisis and reaction to it, or just because of evolving things. It seems like, you know, if I'm planning my business and looking ahead at the accounting rules, at the legal rules, I'm not so sure I know what they are or that I can project what they're going to be 5 years from now.
You know what? And you can't. And I have clients where, for example, I represent a startup healthcare company. And the healthcare laws, that's an incredibly regulated field. And the laws are changing all the time. And there are always new federal laws on the subject. And so their job, they're always going to have to be changing their business and changing their contracts to comply and changing their business model. That's just how life is. And so I think that a successful company is one that can be dynamic and grow and change as the environment changes.
And yet, if you're not big enough to have an in-house attorney who's there, you know, looking over your shoulder, if you are a startup firm, you know, what do you budget for that? How do you decide how much legal counsel I'm going to need? Because obviously, I'm assuming you can't do this for free for everybody. Your job is there to provide them an answer. Maybe you provide some of it for free, and maybe you charge them for something. And it seems like how do both sides figure out? How do they figure out how much they want to spend on you telling them look ahead 5 years, and how do you bill them for that kind of advice?
Well, we start out small, obviously, and I try to figure out what their needs are, and we try to do the things that have to be done first. Just, you know, sort of a triage process.
Mm-hmm.
We try to figure out and budget for the things that have to be done. For example, I have a healthcare company, like I said. Obviously, we have contracts that have to be in compliance with federal law, so we try to work on those. I have other companies, you know, and they have to protect their trademark, so that's something they have to
right.
budget for, but we try to do it within the timeline that they can afford, and I try to be cognizant of their cash flow and that sort of thing. But obviously, I don't think, in my opinion, that legal advice is anything that you can ever under budget for.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's always, they're always going to be a need for it, and I just think it's something, unfortunately, it's just one of the costs of doing business. But if you have a good attorney who's not just out there to bail you all the time, and you consult them you know, as needed and as necessary, then I think most clients are going to be okay with that.
Do you tell people then, hey, you know, this is something I'm going to have to bill you for, and as opposed to I'm just calling you up and saying, hey, can you give me a quick answer to something here? I mean, do we?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. In fact, I try to give them a timeline. If they ask me to look into something, I say, you know what, that's going to take several hours for me to do. You know, just make sure you're okay with that, because I don't want them to be shocked at the end of the month when they get the bill.
Right. Right, good. Okay, well, it sounds like you've really thought this out and are working out some practical ways to make mm-hmm. an attorney a continuing part of the process here.
Definitely a work in progress.
There you go. All right, we all are. Well, and that's, I go back to what you said earlier, too many times, and it's my experience as well, you go get the attorney and then you think, good, I'm done with that. I don't have to talk to them for years now. And let's just go ahead and we've got the legal entity in place or we've got the guidelines and let's go. And then all of a sudden the guidelines change or they get in trouble or they forget. And now they're coming to you to try and fix something that could have been much easier addressed had they invested a little time and effort in the beginning rather than trying to go right. back and fix it.
Much easier and less expensive to
yes.
do it on the front end.
Okay. So make your attorney your friend. Make him part of the team here. Okay.
Exactly.
Take a lawyer to lunch. This is Take a Lawyer to Lunch week here.
There you go.
All right. Well, if they want to take you to lunch, how do they get in touch with you?
The best way is to look at my, as I mentioned before, I'm affiliated with an all-female group of attorneys. Some are freelance and some are like me and they have their own firm. And that website is montagelegal.com. That's M-O-N-T-A-G-E legal.com.
Okay. Anything else that I didn't cover you'd like to insert here? You got 60 seconds and a megaphone.
No, gosh, I think that's it. Other than I think you can look at the blog on Montage and check out our profiles, and you can see I think that we are going to be the wave of the future of attorneys banding together because they decided that they wanted the work-life balance and that they just wanted to break away from the traditional law practice.
If I had known such a thing existed, I might have stayed in law school. But unfortunately for me, it's 30 years too late here. So anyway, thank you so much for joining us here on Critical Mass for Business. And we wish you all the best. And we hope that people will call you from the show and connect with you. So thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a quick break to say a word from our sponsor. And then we'll be back with our second guest right after this.
Smart Business Network is a business-to-business multimedia company providing insight, advice, and strategy for C-level executives of fast growth, middle market, and large companies. As one of the nation's largest publishers of local management journals, under the Smart Business name, Smart Business Network publishes 19 regional print editions, presents dozens of large and small-scale business conferences and award programs, and produces a vibrant interactive digital media presence. For more information, visit us at www.sbnonline.com.
Okay, and we're going to talk now with our second guest here, Francine Silverman. Welcome to Critical Mass, the radio show.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. It's so nice to be here.
I'm going to disclose to the audience, I'm going to publicly shame myself here for not getting in touch with you sooner. I know we had connected a long time ago. I don't know whether I found you or you found me, but I know you were very persistent in calling me, and I was very bad in calling you back. So I'm going to start by apologizing.
Oh, no problem.
And I'm glad that we're going to have the conversation today on the air. That's probably a better place to do it because then we can share it with the world here and tell
Absolutely.
Everybody about what you do here. Tell us what you do because
okay,
I think it's very
I
unique.
Do. Okay, what I do. Okay, in 2003, I started an e-zine called Book Promotion Newsletter because
okay.
I had two local travel books that I had written, and I didn't know how to promote them. So
okay.
I thought, if I start a newsletter online, I'll get authors, and I'll have them fill out a questionnaire, which they did. And needless to say, I built it up and built it up. And then about 2 years later, I saw people were starting radio shows, so I started a radio show for authors.
Okay.
And then somebody, one of my subscribers, met me for lunch, and she said, you really should package your services. And I said, that's a good idea. So I proposed to my subscribers that I would represent them online.
Hmm.
And a lot of them signed up. And what I started to do was I started by trying to get them into newspapers, and I realized it was an uphill battle.
Right.
And I did get them into two major newspapers, but it took a long time. But no sooner did I pitch radio hosts, I was amazed to see that they really were desperate for guests.
Oh, all the time.
And I started, you know, I would ask them if I could send them bios, and they said yes, and then I would start sending bios. And before you knew it, I was getting my clients on the radio. And it has grown and grown and grown, and I find that a lot of the radio hosts that I get them, you know, that I get them on the shows become my clients.
Sure. Why not?
Because they see that I'm what I'm doing. And I'm an online publicist, not a regular publicist,
okay.
So I don't charge much money, and I only work online. So that's what I do. And I'm also working, I had a radio show recently called Ship to Shore with Silverman about cruises.
Mm-hmm.
And I had it on Blog Talk Radio, and I was tired of, you know, not knowing if anybody was listening.
Right,
so I decided that I wanted to be on the air. And I'm working on that now with a number of cruise experts, and we're planning on being on WBLQ, which is in Rhode Island.
Ah, okay.
And I'm really excited about that.
Well, you can always come talk to us here at OC Talk Radio. We're always looking for programming here. We're somewhere probably between Blog Talk, which is really a good place to start if you want to try and experiment doing a show, but it really comes off more as podcasts. It's like millions of individual podcasts.
When you want to start out, start on Blog Talk Radio because it's free, at least for a half an hour show. I think they started charging people for longer.
They have. I think they've gone up to now 100 or 200 bucks or something. But there's like a free level that you don't get much, and then if you want to have a little more, if you want to have talk by Skype, which sounds better, if you want to get a few other little things, then they'll add to it. But
yeah, in fact, the person at the WB said she likes to use Skype.
Mm-hmm.
So I reactivated my Skype.
We use Skype here for most of the hosts. There are very few hosts that come to our studio. I built this beautiful little studio, and nobody comes to it. Because with Skype, you get a couple things. One, you can do it from anywhere. The sound is almost the same as if you were live in the studio because it's a digital signal. You're not taking not to get too technical, but you're not taking an analog signal, turning it into digital, and losing something in the process like you do with a phone or other things. And the other thing is that with Skype, at least it's the case in our station, when the host is hosting, I can see them and they can see me. So the advantage you get when you go to a terrestrial station or even an internet station like we've created here is that you get an engineer now. You're not just doing it by yourself. On Blog Talk, you're a one-man band. You're doing everything. You're trying to call.
Yes, that's true. And it's kind of lonely.
It's lonely, and it's hard to do if you try. If you're just going to talk, it's not as hard. But if you're going to have guests and commercials and other things, it's hard to be focused on giving good content and at the same time queuing up the next thing and calling the next guest.
Have any commercials. I just spoke and had my guests speak for a half an hour.
Right.
But, you know, and it seems from the archives that people were listening, but, you know, it's really hard to know. You have no sense.
And that's what we try to do at our radio station. Our idea was to be somewhere between terrestrial radio, which is expensive, and Blog Talk, which is free. So we charge, you know, $300-$400 a month, something like the $300 for a biweekly show, $500 for a weekly show. And having said that, what you get is somebody there who can help engineer the show for you, and then we also try and help
promote it. Airtime is expensive.
Oh, it is.
I know. That's why I was looking for a lot of co-hosts.
Yeah,
I think
right.
With a lot of co-hosts, I may end up as the producer and not even on the air.
Yeah, and there is a function for both. Today I'm acting as producer and host, and I tell you, it's not so easy. I'm trying to juggle five things at once. Much easier when I'm just producing the show. And Rick can see, and again, using Skype, we can see each other. I'm still Roz to his Fraser, you know, to use that analogy. I'm still the producer behind the glass, but the glass is now the computer screen. So the host sees me and I see them, and I can give them hand signals, and we can type back and forth to each other on a separate chat line. Hey, you know, your guest is ready, or you got a caller on line two. And at the same time, you have a producer who's there to, you know, cue up all this stuff and everything else. Plus, we also, like a true producer, go out and try and find guests and help promote the shows,
well,
too.
Well, where is your studio?
It's in Orange County, California. We're in Southern California.
Oh, okay.
So we do it from a small studio, and we went out and bought all the real broadcast equipment and, you know, set it all up. It's amazing. I was in terrestrial radio a million years ago. I was a disc jockey in Virginia and other places. And when I left that, I thought, I guess I'll never come back to radio again. And it's weird how I've come full circle back to radio. But the equipment that you can purchase today is so much more sophisticated and so much less expensive than what we used to try and do back in the 70s and 80s when I was a disc jockey.
Were you were a disc jockey or you were a producer?
WMYK, K94. Yeah, I was on-air talent for a rock radio station back in Norfolk, Virginia. I had to learn to say Norfolk and not laugh. But
So now you're on a talk radio.
Yeah, I think I think that's the evolution. I mean, talk radio has been the growth medium for a long time, and everything's going to the internet. Everything is going to the internet. You know, newspapers are going out of business. Our own paper here in Orange County has filed bankruptcy. All paper in San Diego's bankrupt. All these papers are going out, and they're all because people are getting their information on the internet. It's the one device we're tethered to all day long, whether it's your phone or your laptop or your iPad or something. It's the one thing you've got on and you're checking with all the time. So as newspapers go online, as TV goes online, as movies go online, like Netflix, Blockbuster is ready to go out of business, this huge company, because nobody wants to drive to the store and get it anymore. You can just download it off of Netflix.
It's true.
Yeah,
it's
crazy.
The internet has destroyed a lot of businesses.
If you really look at terrestrial radio, that's why they're in trouble. All these groups like Citadel and Clear Channel that bought up all these stations.
Yeah, but a lot of shows that are on the air are also on the internet. So
well, exactly, and that's they're trying to move their audience from one medium to the next. We just did an article on our blog talking about the number of car manufacturers. The last bastion of terrestrial radio is in your car, and how they're all put bit by bit. Hyundai and Honda and BMW are all, and Ford, in one way or another, going to give you internet access into your car. They're all scared because they're afraid you're going to be reading instead of driving. But at the same time, it allows you to get things like SiriusXM and satellite radio and Pandora and all these other music services in your car. And so I think eventually it's going to happen. They're going to need those airwaves for other things, just like they took away the public television airwaves. You can't get TV through the air anymore, except for a few high-definition channels. You know, they took that and they used it for something else. Eventually, I think they're going to do the same thing with terrestrial radio.
What do you mean
radio?
You can't get television on the air anymore?
A couple years ago, they took away the analog bandwidth. So if you have a little TV, let's say you have a 10-year-old TV, and you just want to turn it on and see if you get anything, and it's not hooked up to cable, you get nothing. If you have one of these, there are portable HD, because what they did is they switched everybody to high-definition television signals. They went away from the traditional analog signal that operated at a lower frequency.
Oh, it has to be attached to the cable?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah. If you're not attached to cable, you get... I have to be careful how I say this. If you have a television that's old and you turn it on and it's not attached to a cable, you get nothing. There is no signal floating through the air anymore.
I didn't realize that. I thought it was an option to have cable. I didn't realize that you had to have it.
Now, the exception would be if you had a new television. There are some portable TVs that have that high-definition signal, which is at a different frequency. And so that frequency still floats through the air. But the old analog frequency that we all grew up with, that we've all had since the birth of television, that's gone. They took that bandwidth and sold it off for other things, cell phones or something. So eventually that public, you know, there's only so many signals available in the airwaves out there. And eventually...
Well, I spend so much time on the internet, I have little time for TV.
Yeah, you're not alone. Well, let's talk about, you know, enough about the future of radio here. You found this niche. It's working for you here. What have you learned along the way out of this evolution here? What can you share with other small businesses as you've transitioned from one to another?
I can say that I have started 16 e-books of talk radio shows.
Wow, 16 e-books, okay.
Yes, ranging from animals to sports. And a painful lesson that I learned was I thought that if I wrote a book, which I did, called Talk Radio Wants You, a guide to 700 shows and how to get invited, that it was unique, and I was wondering why nobody else ever did it. But after it was published, and I struggled to find a traditional publisher. I really wanted one. finally found one. They published it. And after they published it, I realized that, number one, radio shows come and go.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, you can't take a show and take it out of the book.
Hmm.
You have to leave it there.
Yeah,
so when I found out that shows were going off the air and my book was already in production, they had to put a notation in "now off the air" in the book.
Because you're trying to take an old-fashioned medium, I'll call it old-fashioned here, which is paper. You know, you got to cut a tree down and chop it up and print on it here. And then you go and drive, and that book gets, medium changes so fast that the publisher can't keep up with it.
No, and I realized also that not everybody needs 700 shows. Some people are, say they're business people. They just want business. So an e-book they could buy very cheaply, my business e-book.
Right.
Or they're very interested in animals. They could buy my animals e-book. Or they're very interested in sports. They could buy my sports e-book.
And you can obviously keep it up to date quicker because you're updating it instantly.
Yes, and I could take shows out. I could put them in. It's so easy. And it makes so much more sense.
Now, let's talk about that publishing.
Even the New York Times is now including e-books.
Oh, yeah. I'm fascinated with the idea of e-books. What, you know, let me ask you a couple questions then about e-books here. They come in different formats. There's the EPUB, which is used by Amazon and some others. And then there are other ones that have their own proprietary formats and stuff. How do you handle all these different formats?
Well, what it is, I have my e-book in Word.
Okay.
Microsoft Word, and I convert it to a PDF.
Right. A public document format.
Yeah.
Adobe PDF.
I convert
PDF.
It. But I have an affiliate, Smashwords, and they want your Word document because they then go ahead and they convert it to about 5 or 6 different formats.
Ah, okay. And what's the name of that company?
It's called Smashwords.
Okay. And can you just find them on the internet, smashwords.com
yes.
or something? Yeah.
Smashwords.com.
Okay.
Was it Smashbooks? Smashwords. No, smashwords.com.
Okay.
And they're terrific about selling my e-books.
And do they take then a cut?
They take a cut, yes.
Okay. And then they get it out to all these different formats. Because each of the different readers, like anything, hasn't been an agreed-upon format. So if you've got the Kindle, it reads one type of thing, the Amazon.com
stuff. In other words, it can be adapted to any format.
Right. There's 3 or 4 different formats of readers out there right now. Okay. All right. Well, then that was the breakthrough.
And people can go to my website at talkradioadvocate.com.
Okay.
And they can read the descriptions of the e-books and the prices. And they range in price from $12 to $20, depending on how many shows I have in the e-book.
Okay. All right. Do you also sell them through Amazon.com and things like that?
Well, some of them are on Amazon, but I put my e-books on, I think it was Lightning Source or some other website that's connected to Amazon. But once they're on there, you can't do anything about it. You have to. They just have to sell them as you send them there. So they're not up to date. Whereas Smashwords, you can constantly update the e-book.
Okay. Well, we're going to have...
Constantly, and that's what I do. I constantly update it.
You have
because
answered...
every time I get a new show, you know, I update it.
You've answered my question, and that's what I was trying to figure out. How did you learn how to turn these into e-books?
It's a wonderful service.
Okay, and let me ask you the tough question. Has it worked for you? I mean, are they selling?
Well, the way I sell the e-books is I sell them through my newsletter. That's one way. People know me, so they trust me, and they see that every time the newsletter comes out, I put all the names of the newsletters and the descriptions and everything else and the prices. and through this affiliate. I tried a number of affiliates, but none of them worked as well as Smashwords.
Okay. Well, maybe we could, that's what you and I were originally going to talk about, is maybe we could find a way to sell the, at least the radio books through
our site. I tried so many different ways. I sent out press releases. I even got a number of my hosts in my book to guarantee interviews to anyone who bought the ebook.
Wow. Okay.
And I put that in the press release, and that didn't work.
So you're still experimenting, and I think that is the challenge. You know, you're still experimenting how to get people on the internet to find you, and that's the challenge. We have this radio show. It's a challenge and a half. Yeah. Because it's gone from one extreme to the other. We used to only have three or four TV channels. Now you got millions of them on cable. We used to have only a couple radio signals you could listen to in your area. Now you can listen to millions of podcasts and millions of live podcasts, live radio shows like this one. So, you know, how do you find each other and how do you get that message out there? That's why we've tried to focus on one community, and we partner with local newspapers, and we send out, you know, our own tweets and Facebook and do our other social media to build it up. And we do live appearances and live remotes throughout Orange County. So through
yes,
that,
well,
bit
you,
by bit.
You have to try everything.
Yeah, bit by bit.
And when my radio show, I used to give my website all the time. Didn't know who was listening, but, you know, I just talked about my e-books. And
well, because the internet's a strange cat. You know, it doesn't adjust. It isn't just a one-shot thing. You'll find that if you go on terrestrial radio, like I was a million years ago, if they miss your show, they miss your show. But now, if it's also simulcast on the internet, or if it's exclusively on the internet, you have the ability to record it and turn it into
exactly.
a podcast.
Most yeah. radio stations are streamed on the internet.
Yeah. The problem that they're having is that, you know, if they're a music channel, they're getting hit, they have to pay two fees, not one. So when they play that song by the Beatles get a royalty for it to appear on the air, and they get a separate royalty when it appears on the internet. And that's what's limiting the number of radio stations that broadcast now on the internet, because they have a separate, if they're using any sort of licensed material, any copyrighted material, they have to pay twice, which is, again, one of the reasons why talk radio is different, because we don't have those issues. If we play music, exactly.
I don't have to worry about that.
Right. Well, fascinating stuff here. How do people, let's go through very carefully. How do they, let's start with how they get in touch with you, if they wanted
well,
to
Well, they
be.
Can go to my website, as I said, talkradioadvocate.com. My email is all over the website.
Okay.
And I'd like them to look at the e-books and see which one interests them. You know, there are descriptions, there are prices.
And how do you keep your book updated? I know you've sent out a flyer, which I welcome to a number of the hosts here on OC Talk Radio. I'm sure there are other.
Oh, I have a number of radio shows that responded to my questionnaire.
Good, good. Well, if you
from OC, yeah.
I hope that you do,
including your show.
Yeah, right. This show, right? I think that's how you got in touch with Rick here.
Critical Mass, yes.
Critical Mass for Business. Okay, and if they want to learn more, I mean, are you open to having people call you and discuss how to promote their radio show or promote
well,
their book?
Well, they can email me at franalive,
okay.
A-L-I-V-E, franalive, at optonline.net.
At opt, like U-P-P?
O-P-T.
Oh, opt, okay.
optonline.net.
Okay, all right, good. Well, I wish you the best. I think that we're all in this together. We're trying to find a way to create a new medium, and that is over the internet. And that means there's new rules how to promote it. There's new rules how to attract an audience and find an audience. And there are new rules on how this medium works. You don't just listen to it live. You can also put it on your iPod and jog and listen to it, or put it in your car. That's what's coming next, and listen to it. You know, I think we're in an exciting time. We're seeing a transition from one world to another.
Exactly, and it's a wonderful world.
and you know.
And Paul, I want to thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you, and I hope that you will put this on your website so that we can share with people, your audience, this information, and that's how we all cross-promote each other here and tell each other what
Sounds
we're doing.
Good.
All right. Thank you so much
Thank
for joining
you.
Us. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it. Two totally different sorts of things, but the one thread they had in common is two people doing their own thing. That's what this show finds more and more. You know, here's an attorney who left big law firms so she could have her own life back again. And in return, she has discovered there are others out there like her, and they've banded together to form this kind of strategic alliance with other women attorneys who are in the same boat. And that's what this thing she was talking about. Let me get the name of that site again, which is the Montage, M-O-N-T-A-G-E Legal Group. And then you've got a woman like Francine Silverman, who starts off in one direction to write her own books and discovers that in promoting them, she finds it isn't as easy as she thought. And as she discovers how to do it, she thinks, hey, maybe I can do this for others. And that's what she's doing. So I think e-books and online and do-it-yourself stuff is the wave of the future here. So that's what this radio station's founded upon, the idea that anybody can have a voice on the Internet. So we want to thank you for joining us here today, and we look forward to having you with us tomorrow when we do coast-to-coast version of Critical Mass, where we talk to businesses not only locally here in Orange County but across the country to help gather information to help move your business in a positive direction. Thanks for listening, and if you have any further interest in past shows, you can certainly go to the Critical Mass website at octalkradio.net or go straight to the source, criticalmassforbusiness.com. Thanks for listening, and we will see you tomorrow. And of course, as I always say at this point, you've been listening to octalkradio.net and Critical Mass, the radio show.